title of this session is In Dialogue with African Traditional Religions and Cultures. And the first of three sessions on this topic, dealing with some issues related to creation. Some preliminary things before we get into the topic itself. Before having my present position, we were for a time, as has been announced and in some previous classes, some of you are aware, we were missionaries in Ethiopia. Before going there, I would have to say that I never pictured myself as a missionary, and I never wanted to be one, and never had it as a goal to be a missionary. And before going and accepting the call from the church's division to go there, I had to wrestle with and continue to wrestle with a lot of stereotypes in my mind, and a lot of the misconceptions, and how I would fit into such an enterprise. It was a shock, really, when a phone call came one day, and the personnel director of the Division for World Missions said, totally out of the blue, your name has been suggested as someone who might be interested in a change in your pastoral career. Well, it made quite a change, all right. And I think that one of the reasons for the hesitancy is built around the subject of trying to appreciate the traditional cultures and religions of the people, in this case, of Africa, and having a sense that it is not our task or our calling or our right to change people or to insist that they change or to have them become like us. And that continues to be in my mind as an issue as we think of carrying out mission around the world, as we work interdependently with other people and other cultures. It soon became apparent after going there that there was a clash of cultures, and that no matter how hard we try, we carry with us the gospel, the good news, within a culture. And even when we think we are not, we recognize, or it becomes apparent to us, that we come with a worldview, with an understanding of the world and things within us that we can't change because it's who we are. We're conditioned by our culture. Our faith is carried, in a sense, by culture. I remember some simple things like the awareness of time. One of the things that Westerners often have difficulty with in Africa is a different view of time and of keeping appointments and of being on time. We usually criticize Africans for the lack of punctuality when they're a half hour or an hour late. If you're invited to dinner somewhere, depending on how traditional the people are, it might be the best manners to be an hour late, because only the poor and hungry come on time. And one realizes that you make an appointment with someone, say, for the next morning. We would do it on the basis of a time, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 9:30, and expect that the person would keep the appointment. It might happen in the midst of all of that, that something else has come up in that person's life that takes priority. And the fact that you were there first, in line and making a schedule according to a clock, is really not the controlling reason for keeping or failing to keep an appointment. But relationships are. And there might be something within the relationship that of that person that preempts the time. Or you may be late in coming, or he might, or she might. If you're a guest in someone's home, you would then go according to their schedule. You would not say, well, I have an appointment at 8 o'clock, I'd like to have breakfast at 7:30. You know, that would be most inappropriate. Your schedule would be determined by fitting into the flow and pattern of that household. And as you become accustomed to it, it becomes more natural that, yes, their schedule is based on relationships and not on a clock. The relationships dictate it, and really that is, to my way of thinking, more healthy. But it was one way in which you recognize, in a small sense, the clash of cultures and of understandings of life. I remember giving a compliment to an Ethiopian man, telling him he had grown a beard, and I said, "Now it really makes you look young." Well, that's not something you say to an African to compliment them. As much as we in our society, in our culture, try to look young and find it as a compliment to be told we look young, we think of it as energetic and youthful and all. What I said to him, as he understood it, was, "You are really irresponsible. You know, youth is not something to be desired, something to grow out of when you become fully human, when you become an adult. And if you're fully, fully human, you are old. And the older you are, the more respect you have." I would go to the post office, and for example, and they've not learned the meaning of waiting in line or in a queue. There's just a mash of people at every window with papers holding and people reaching over. And if they would see my bald head and beard, I would get first treatment. And they would say, you know, "Move aside," sort of like, you know, get rid of the children so that we can get with the true adult, if it became apparent that those in front were younger. That also indicated a clash of cultures and a way of understanding and looking at the world. And you can imagine, as the confrontation of Christianity through missionaries came into traditional cultures in many ways, there have been a lot of conflicts. The recognition, for example, as we'll see in the section on health, the difficulty of someone who believes that illness comes out of broken relationships, to have a comprehension that there are some illnesses that come from things called germs or bacteria, that represents a different perspective on how you look at the realities that are happening around you. Or the relationship of new cultures and faiths to something like polygamy. Some sharp contrasts in understandings of life. And I would like in our discussions to avoid two extremes. On the one hand, cultural supremacy, that our way is the best, and our mission is to help other people to become like us and to share our way, our technological understanding, our rational view of the world, our scientific method of inquiry, all of these things that are part of our culture is what the world needs. And we say, well, certainly I'm not a cultural supremacist, but, you know, you just stop and think. When you think about the problems that other parts of the world have, our immediate sense is to ask the questions as a problem-solving people as to how our technology, how our way of thinking can be applied to their problems. And we do that now with the famine. How can our forms of agriculture be used? How can our forms of nutrition, how can our forms of education? And there's a lot of validity to it, but we have to guard ourselves against thinking that we are the answer people. And the technological, rational, logical, scientific view is the way for all people to understand their life and to come to meaning. And I'd like to prod you and to try to get out of that mindset every now and then to think how other people do look at the world. The other side of the other extreme of a cultural supremacist is is a kind of a romanticizing of what are often called primal cultures or traditional belief systems, as though if they were just left alone, their life would be idyllic, that there would be no problems, that every life would go on. They've gone this way for centuries, and they should be just left alone. And that also has problems within it, because left alone, infant mortality is terribly high. Parents losing children is never a happy, romantic kind of view of life and nutrition. Things of cultures need to be challenged, I think. And one has to work with people to see where they need to be challenged, just as our culture has things within it that need to be challenged. Female circumcision, for example, is something widely prevalent in a lot of African cultures, in which many, many young girls are infected and die, and really the whole purpose of the operation in the first place is to take away whatever gratification or personal satisfaction there is from sexual intercourse, so that there is a greater possibility for male dominance. Well, should this practice simply be, go unchallenged in a kind of a romanticized view of cultures, or is there something in which there is a value system that's higher than either of our cultures that speaks to both? And that would be my point of view, that there is, within the Creator's intention for his or her world, ways that every culture needs to be challenged. The difficulties comes from who challenges whom, and how are those challenges offered and issued. I have put the title on the board here, African Traditional Religions and Cultures, and put the kind of catchword there, AFTRAC, as a shortened way of looking at it. Sounds like a railroad company. But maybe we can use that term to avoid saying the whole phrase. And I think I want to say the whole phrase every time I use it, because I want to emphasize every part of those words, the African, the traditional, the religion, and the culture, as an intertwined whole. And see that the religion and the culture must be seen together. I put some characteristics on the board also for us to think about as we plunge into this topic. The first is diverse, that AFTRACs, we can use that expression, are diverse throughout the continent, through the 800 more different ethnic groups of Africa. And there's some similarities between them, and that's where we want to focus, but there's a danger in talking about all of them as though there's some cohesiveness to all African tradition, religions, and cultures. One thing that can be said as a kind of a similarity that runs through them is that they are relational. That is, that they have to do with the religions and the cultures of the people have to do with their relationships within families and living in clan and tribe. Everything is focused on how people live together. It's religion and culture. And one of the sources that I've listed up here as places where someone might further explore this, or where I've looked at some things, the first is John Mbiti, who uses the term religion and philosophy to show this intertwining of thought, of culture and religion. Another resource is some work done by one of our Lutheran missionaries, Dean Peterson, who's still working in East Africa and who's done considerable work in the relationship of Christianity and traditional religions and cultures. And then the third one, Perinder, and Africa's three religions. But to emphasize that the relational aspect, in such faiths and cultures, you are born into it. The beliefs give kind of integrity to all of the social interactions, all of the family living, all of the practices of law and the settlement of disputes within the village, within the people. The roles of male and female are clearly outlined in the religion and culture. The age groups, the movement of people through age groups, the passage rites. Questions that relate to illness and death and marriage and birth, all of the major events in a life are all intertwined in the culture and religion together of people practicing a traditional belief system in their village. The third characteristic is that has almost always been oral. The story, the proverb are very important and significant in traditional African ways of life. And with it comes the beauty of language. Some of the African languages have a tremendous poetic beauty to the stories and to the proverbs. Because all of the teaching is done that way. And the teaching is done as it's carried forward, and proverbs are handed down as a mother teaches children, as a father teaches children. It's done this way, and you'll find some very tremendous orators among African people, particularly in their own language, and using rhyme and rhythm and timing and imagery that to me is fantastic. And this, the culture is oral also because it encompasses many, not just one. There's very little of a kind of individualized faith. It's lived out, going back to the second point, relational. And fourthly, almost all of them have expression in music. Music is important as people work, as they carry out all the normal functions of living day to day, of singing together, of hearing them in working in the farm and hoeing, of coming down in rhythm with their hoes, of building houses, of wedding days, of passage rites of children into adulthood. All events are celebrated in music. And music, again, is always for groups. It's always a collective event. It would be strange for an African to think of going someplace and listening to somebody sing without participation. And I think there's something of a kind of a genuine culture that comes through our young people to go to concerts. And as things get moving, everyone's out of their seats and in the aisles and dancing, and there's a participation in the concert that an African would certainly understand, because their music and expressiveness is also done as a group and as participation. And that certainly carries forward into worship, where there are traditional forms of worship. And a fifth point is to one that's been running through several of these items, is that the faith and culture is very much a community practice and community based on ethnicity. The tribe or the nation, as they would think of the tribe, their culture and language group forms their understanding. And once again, to emphasize, it's collective rather than individual. Well, with those kind of beginning statements about things that might be said in general about African traditional religions and cultures, let's look at some things that relate to creation. And as we do this, we're trying to look at ways that there might be points of dialogue, of understanding, of helpful insights in both directions for us to understand creation and Creator, where the faiths might converge, where they might inform one another, or where they might be in conflict. In most traditional African belief systems, there is ready reference to God as Creator. Ready reference to God or a supreme being or spirit that is the sustainer of all that is. And it's somewhat refreshing to know how comfortably and naturally Africans refer to God in relation to creation and the created order, and what he does with and in his world. There is much evidence in most African systems in the names for God that would point to God as creator or as maker or potter or builder or other terms that would have to do with construction or making or doing, as well as family names that refer to a parental relationship to the world. The scope and the supremacy of the Creator is often somewhat limited to the ethnic boundaries of a language group or of a culture group. The ethnicity of the people informs their worldview, and it's somewhat difficult to imagine moving beyond that, or to think of a God that is more than a God of us. There is some difficulty in many of such faiths to think of a personal God in the sense of a personal relationship, rather than as more distant. Who is the potter, the maker, the builder, the creator, the father, the mother, but maybe is somewhat removed. There's a strong emphasis that the Creator continues his involvement with the world, for human and non-human alike, that he continues, or she, Creator, continues to have involvement in the rain and the sun, and the health, the offspring, the gift of children to a clan or to a family. There are within most African systems also a story of a fall, or some kind of separation from God, in which the created order and humankind is separated from the high God. Interesting how these myths are everywhere, in one form or another. Some that have striking similarity to the biblical story of the fall, and others that are not so similar. Among the Maasai people, very distinct nomadic or semi-nomadic cattle herders of East Africa have ancient stories that have come down through their oral tradition of heaven and earth having been touched by a ladder of skins, which would be very understandable in a culture that makes a great deal out of cattle. All cattle in the world belong to the Maasai. They're very honest people, except when it comes to cattle, honest in the Western sense. The Maasai would not steal anything, but when they take cattle, it's only returning to the Maasai what the Creator originally gave to the Maasai, all the cattle. And if temporarily some other tribes happen to have cattle, it's just bringing back to the Creator's intention. But they have this myth of the ladder of skins and the hyena, one of the chief enemies of African people in many parts, is the culprit who chewed up the ladder and therefore created the separation in which the access to God the high God is not so not so easy. In other cases, the culprit has been a human or a human form from an enemy tribe who has somehow broken the link of heaven and earth. Many tribes will see a mountain or a high place as being the point of contact of heaven and earth. You see it in the visual sense, which we still have. You know, heaven is still up somehow, even though in space travel, where is up and everything goes around. But they would look at mountains very much like the biblical writers would look at mountains as being the holy places. Mount Sinai, Mount of Transfiguration, Mount of Temptation, all of the mountains where there are special places of appearances of God, and they would look at mountains as being, in some sense, the navel of the earth, where the connection is made to the parent God. Other tribes, other parts would have different kinds of myths of displacement in which the separation of the high God and earth and humankind occurred. In some cases, it has to do with jealousy within a polygamous family, in which the first wife, who might happen to be barren, is jealous of younger wives who produce children and therefore fulfill woman's role in existence in their way of thinking. And out of jealousy kills the woman, the younger woman, and the blood somehow reaches to heaven and annoys God to move away at a distance. So the jealousy evil is something that moves God away. In many of the other stories, there is, like the way we have often traditionally seen the Eve part of the story, a woman is involved in the irritation of the high God. There's harmony and closeness still present, and the high God still has the welfare and the productivity of creation in mind, but it's not as close as it once was. One word that's often used to describe African traditional religions is the word animism. And I'd like to suggest that this is an insufficient word to describe African religions and cultures, because it describes a part of, but not the totality. Animism refers to the fact that Africans believe that all of creation is animated. That is, it has spirit. There is a spiritual force, a secret power, which pervades human and non-human, biological and non-biological life. Everything is filled with spirit. And I suppose if we were to think of, in terms of Christianity, it would be like calling Christianity forgivenessism. Or something, a very vital part of the faith, but it isn't something that we would characterize and say, well, you know, what religion are you? I'm a forgivenessist or something. I'm an animist would have that kind of feeling that's one aspect, a very central one, but it doesn't describe the totality of the relationships, which are probably more significant than the fact of the belief in the animation of everything in the world. And we'll see in some of the other sessions, particularly one relating to health and wholeness and salvation tomorrow, that there are certain people within families or tribes that have capabilities of linking with these powers, and the Messiah figures are more the kind of healers or the traditional healers that have the ability to make the links between the human situations, the illnesses, the needs, and the powers. Now, we use terms like witch doctor, which, puts somebody in a funny mask and somebody who can ridicule, who has these wild beliefs that nobody believes anymore. But I would much prefer that we'd use terms like traditional healer, something that gives more of a credibility or an understanding to the vital part that such people play. And quite often they are the wise people of the village or the clan. There are frauds, and there are people within that that take advantage of other people, there's no question. But there are also those that use the power, which in some way has been given to them, to make the linkage with the secret power or the spiritual force that animates all that God has made. Think of that perhaps in something like ecology. I think we're coming back to something that a lot of African traditionalists have had for a long time, that there is a link between all aspects of nature and creation. Now, we don't go out apologizing to the spirit of a tree for cutting it down, as maybe a traditionalist would, and give the spirit of the tree time to move to another tree, while we apologize for the need of cutting the tree down and so on. But that sense of the interrelatedness of nature, I think, is something that is an important ingredient that can come to our understanding of creation, rather than having this mentality of the rape of the earth, of which our culture has very often been guilty. All of the interconnectedness is disregarded for the sake of taking from nature and from the earth what we need and what is for our benefit, without thinking of the linkages and how it affects other plant and animal life and the rest of creation. As we think about the relationship to Christianity, of some of these traditional ways of seeing the Creator, there have been linkages among Christians and traditional people in the understanding of the high God. There would be in many, many African aftracts a rejection of the notion that there is a God who also cares for the enemy. And that would there would very often be quite a leap of faith to go from the God who is God of our tribe, this ethnocentric God, to think of one who is also God and protector and caring for enemies. I think we can look at the Old Testament and see some correlation to that understanding as well, that how can God be the God of these chosen ones who have been led out and also be the God of the one that we are conquering. God is our God. And subservient to our tribe's concerns and to our being right. Some difficulty with that kind of understanding, and I think as we let the words roll around in our brain a bit, we could probably find that we aren't so far off from African traditional religions in that respect. God is on our side. The American God, the mandate that God has given to us to save the world. Even to mention mentioned when President Reagan made his comment at the honoring of some soldiers, the soldiers who were killed in El Salvador. And at the close of that speech, he said, when we reach the heavenly scene, the gates will be guarded by U.S. Marines. And, you know, I cannot believe that he actually said that. And he did. And no one raised any furor that I could see about that. But, you know, that is precisely the kind of ethnocentric God, that he is our God, and it is we who are within a chosen and special position. And that, I think, is one place where dialogue has gone on in the relationship to African traditional religions and cultures as well, is their understanding or their difficulty of understanding a God who was also God of all people, or of particularly of the enemy. Another point of dialogue in the creation stories and in the fall, in most of the African traditional faiths, it seems that God pulls back for one reason or another, either out of disgust for what has gone on in the world, but the Creator God has pulled back. And in the biblical story, there's much more of God's acting of expelling humankind from the garden, from the presence. And the action of God in that seems to be somewhat subtle, but perhaps not subtle, in speaking to a way of understanding, which, as we will see, makes it difficult often, and also an expression of great relief that there is a God who takes action in behalf of his people, or who reaches out and comes to his or her people. The story doesn't have the kind of historicity hang-ups that we have as to whether there really was an Adam or an Eve, and the stories of the hyena chewing the ladder or whatever. These are stories that stand much more in the African way, similarly to the way the Hebrews told the stories in the beginning, not as history, but as a story explaining and pointing to an understanding of beginnings. I think another point of dialogue of our understandings is the holistic view that sees the universe in a spiritual way, that the whole universe is permeated by the spiritual. It's not just, and I think for me as a Christian, the universe is not just chunks of inanimate stuff, but that all of this is something of beauty that's been given to us by God. And the concern for its upkeep is not something that simply good citizens should do, but something that comes out of my relationship to a Creator that we care for and not pollute and not destroy what the Creator has done. And to me, an African point of view has helped me to understand. And I may not go to the same kind of spiritual animism of creation, but that sense of the animation of all of the world has been helpful to me. We are extremely permeated with a scientific and a technological worldview, which often leads to the understanding of the world as simply being a collection of things for our use, and as I mentioned earlier, a kind of rape mentality of creation. One of the limitations of our worldview, I suppose, is that knowledge is only only what can be verified. And knowing then is somewhat impoverished. We have difficulty, I think, as typical, I suppose we're typical, people reading the Bible, listening to sermons, and understanding religious understandings of life with things like dreams and visions and revelations, just as we have difficulty understanding spirit possession and other things that we have somehow or another explained away in some kind of terms. For an African to hear the biblical story of the Mount of Transfiguration and to have Jesus on the mountain talking with Elijah and Moses would be very normal, very understandable. And I think back of how many sermons I've preached on that text or heard, and most of it has to do with, let's get away from this mountaintop experience and now get down in the valley and get to work. Without dwelling on the visionary experience on the mountaintop. We're kind of a little afraid of that. We don't quite know what visions are and that Moses or Elijah could be there from another century, another time. And that way of knowing doesn't fit in with the scientific understanding of what is real. And dreams and visions aren't nearly as real as what takes place in a laboratory or at the end of an equation. That's what's real, what can be proved. And maybe that's not the whole thing. I'm quite sure it isn't. In the African's way of looking at the world, I sometimes fall into what I said at the beginning, we shouldn't, and to over-romanticize, and probably overemphasize for the sake of making a point for us to see that there is some good things in their way of thinking and living that we could learn. And I do believe that we can learn from them on many aspects of life. There are a lot of things within their way of not caring for the earth that has made for a lot of the problems in their continent as well. The overgrazing of semi-desert lands, the burning off of forests as a way of preparing a field for a new planting may not be in the best interests of the care of creation. One sees that at certain seasons of the year through West Africa, through a lot of the rainforest areas where people were burning off huge hillsides. And they would scratch then the ash into the ground and scatter the seed and grow rice on the sides of the hills and then let it go back to bush and back to forest. And you'd see mountains everywhere scarred. And it used to be that they would allow 7 or more years before they go back to that hill. And now, with the increase of population, they're going back to that hill more often and burning it more often. And that may be an ecological non-caring for the earth that is developing out of their cultures, out of a traditional way of farming. I don't know. And I think it's a point at which there is dialogue and pointing to what might be seen as a sin on that side as well. We've mentioned the concept of high God, and however the stories or the myths have the high God removed, he is not in direct contact, and in most African traditional beliefs, there are offerings necessary, or sacrifices, or ablutions, the various kinds of ceremonies to appease the spirits who are between God, the Creator, and people live in now, that there is a kind of hierarchy of moving through, that one does not confront the high God directly, but that moves through divinities, through powers, through ancestral spirits, in other ways to move through. And one of the strong contrasts and one of the reasons for the rapid movement of people with this spiritual understanding and what they see is simply a movement within their systems often into a Christian understanding is the high God pursuing with love and coming directly, not distant and needing appeasement through many intermediaries, but moving directly through his son to this world. Well, those are some thoughts and a very complex kind of picture. I would like to at this time throw it open to you and ask what kind of things might be bubbling around in your brains and spirits, whether a question, whether a comment, whether there's a point of contact that came to you from all of this. Let's have some time to share.
In Isaiah, there is a reference to Ethiopia, Ethiopian Jews returning in the second return. And there's also mention of Ethiopia in Amos. And we also have in the book of Acts the treasurer of Ethiopia that was met on the road by Philip, and he had been to the temple to worship. So it's an assumption that he might have been a Jew. And these Jews that have returned recently to Israel were discovered, I guess, maybe 10 years ago or something. So is it not conceivable that a lot of this in the Ethiopian area might go back 2,500 years to when supposedly the tribe of Dan was taken off?
I'm sure there are many, many contacts of ethnic groups that moved from the eastern end of the Mediterranean down through Africa, and anthropologists and linguists and others have traced some of these movements. Ethiopia is really not, in a way, the name of a place. It comes from a word that means burnt skin, and is kind of a generic term in many cases for Africa. And you'll have in South Africa, for example, the Ethiopian Zion Church, which has nothing to do with the country of Ethiopia, but means the African Zionist Church. But the references that you made show, I think, a lot of contact with the area that is now known as Ethiopia, and which was Abyssinia. The Queen of Sheba had an affair with King Solomon, according to Ethiopian legends, and their son was all other emperors of Ethiopia from that time up to Haile Selassie, who was deposed in 74, claimed that they came from that relationship with the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. And these Falasha Jews that you mentioned have been existing in peace in a certain mountain districts in north central Ethiopia for all these centuries. So its roots certainly in one way or another come from that part of the world. But the official language of Ethiopia is a Semitic language. There are a lot of connections and ties.
The question came to my mind. Was there someone else?
No, go ahead.
You were talking, if I understood you right to begin with, that their religion was a community thing and that God was somewhat far off. Well, now, as they take on Christianity, is there a tendency for it to become more of a personal thing? Or does it still remain a community type thing?
There's certain aspects of it that would become more personal because the thrust and the teaching around it would emphasize much more the personal, but it would certainly remain very much a community thing, more so than, you know, there's a lot of evangelistic crusades that come to Africa and they, you know, people will go to them because they're well done, usually, not always, but, and there's music and there's a good, you know, I hate to use the word entertainment, but that's somewhat the context, because it doesn't really speak to the community, and the community is where life is. There have been a contrast of different kinds of mission strategy as different missiological approaches to Africa have taken place, and some have taken very much the point of view that there must be the individual personal conversion, commitment, personal Lord and Savior before one can call himself or herself a Christian, and that often runs into conflict with much more the collective movement of people into a practice of the faith, which isn't based necessarily on the individual experiences of kind of a born again experience, but there've been some that have made that necessary, and then would look at everyone else as not being fully Christian. And I think those groups that have seen the homogeneous nature of a people moving together into a kind of a fulfillment of their faith is where the real growth of Christianity has come, where it hasn't said everything is pagan and heathen and unholy, and certainly there have been people that have done that, and then later have to kind of catch up again. And bring back, and that has happened as well. To me, it's somewhat of a tragedy that in some areas, in some cases, African Christians have to be taught African music, and that it's all right to use it after being told that it's because they've been used for various other practices that may have been unholy. And you know, I don't think we can claim totally pure roots for all of our hymns either.
Bob Daggy in his sessions talks about Thomas Merton's recognition of God being present in all of life, and almost a pantheistic notion and feeling. And when we talk about that in our tradition, it's more, I get the metaphor more like a fluid that goes through all the things. It infuses everything. It's one of the metaphors to the coming Tuesday. When the Africans talk about it, they talk about being spirit-filled. And now that has a little more lively, a little more personal overtone to me. Is that right? Have any studies been done on the nature of the presence of God and the Spirit in all of life, and is there more of a, animated or more of a, almost like personalized kind of sense of that presence than in our more mystical notions that we have of the total presence of God?
Just trying to remember the precisely some of the things that, like John Mbiti, who's in Africa and writes very well, that would have said, and I don't remember precisely, but it would be good to go back and look. I think that the understanding of the animated world is not always the animation of God or of the high God or of a benevolent God or of a good God, but it would be the animation of all kinds of powers. And sort of sub-spirits or divinities. It would be, we'll look at that with health, that there are ancestral spirits, there are nature spirits, and then sort of as a murky bottom, magical powers. So a person sort of lives within that triangle in which everything is animated by one or another or more of those forces. And they always aren't good spiritual forces. And they all, you know, certainly aren't all kind. Often they keep people living in perpetual fear of my life must be lived to appease all of these powers, and that things that are called voodoo and witchcraft and magic and sorcery and so on are playing upon people's belief in them and the feeling and the knowledge that all these spirit things are real. But the animation then for one who is in a traditional faith is often an animation that is mixed good and bad and would not be seen kind of purely as being animated by a righteous God, but there would be intermediary spirits in between. Yes?
How would baptism, go therefore and baptize, how does this fit in with what you have said about making a new creation out of that person, or is there, how do they relate to that idea?
The African person would be very very appreciative of rites and ceremonies of all kinds, and there would be true in their traditional ways of people moving from various stages in life, moving into marriage, childbirth, all of these things. So they would understand the power of something like baptism as a very strong power, and is very important to their understanding of coming into the faith, becoming part of this new community, and this powerful spirit of Christ, which is more powerful than all these other oppressive spirits. And in places where there are where there's spirit possession, baptism is very often a force that works against the possession. And people that have been baptized very often are never possessed again. And people see that as a strong power and force in their life. So where people become Christians, baptism is very important. And you'll find in many places people just want to get baptized quickly. And they'll try, the Africans themselves will try to have a period of instruction and training before baptism. And people don't want to wait. They'll even sneak into line if the people are being baptized. And because they recognize it as a rite or a ceremony with strong spiritual power.